everybody. Welcome back to the Anti-Media Radio. You're here with LaVon. Happy to be with you here this evening, June 24th, 2016. Happy Friday. What a week it was. You should hear me loud and clear tonight, knocking on all the things that my technical machines comply. Very excited. We have the most awesome show. I'm super, super stoked. I'm checking in with Joseph Simcox, who we talked to precisely a year ago in our excitement towards traveling to Sonoma County for the Heirloom Food Festival. He was there. We didn't get to meet that day, but I became uber aware of him and all of his efforts towards our planet's health as well as our health. He travels the globe collecting seeds, and we've been checking in with him and his awesome perspective. He's going to tell us what he's been working on the last year. He's pretty much revolutionized an old-time method known as crop sharing, where you have somebody who has land but no time or resources, who leases out their land to a farmer, and they not only share the crops but the seeds. So he's pretty much expanding on that notion, but on a larger scale. He's going to tell us all about that. So until he calls in, which should be relatively shortly. Oh, here we go. How exciting. Hi there. You're speaking to LaVon. Is this Joseph?
This is Joseph Simcox. It's a barely daybreak here in Greece where I'm calling from. So I hope that I've reached you.
It's me. I'm here and you're there. Thank you so much for coordinating with me. I know it's not easy when we're super far away, but the audience and I are super excited to hear what you've been up to. And I want to tell them about your new project and go for it. I know you've got a lot to say. Tell us what's been going on.
Well, I mean, of course, the subhammer that I've been traveling almost nonstop for the last 10 years. And the reason for this is because I'm somehow compelled to believe that when we are looking at humanity, it's very different. And I'm speaking about looking at humanity from the perspective of our future, how the people on this planet will be. And as I look at the media, as I look at the popular lore concerning the human population, in a relation to the Earth, mm-hmm. I realize that the vast majority of the literature, vast majority of the media, all concentrates on the fact that we're leading the world, that we're destroying it. In some perspective, there's very little hope unless we evolve a whole new ingredient, namely technology. Technology has, for one reason, become the mainstay promise for salvation for humanity. That is truly inaccurate. And at the same time, in claiming it, I felt it's extraordinarily important to say why it's inaccurate. So, to address, you know, most effectively without making claims, I feel that there's several important things. I've been reading, you know, books over the last 5 years that have all kinds of different opinions about the future of humanity on our planet. It's fascinating. I'm able to see some important ideas about our effects on the planet because the Earth really is an extraordinarily complicated and to give ourselves preeminent we have really changed the course of planet Earth. It's sad. Yes, it can be said that we're changing the way it and our your own little flame, but to think actually affect the way that we destroy very earthly, I mean, extraordinary stupid thing. It's very much late. Why we want to have human being, we view it as how we see ideas. In our modern world, because what we have over the last few centuries is very much by authority. We've created a diverse list of authority that we get credibility to. We're realizing that just went out, they have diversity, and they also have their errors. And so in that sense, we lead people with the innovation. So simple.
Yeah.
Yes. Get together. So, two leanings. First of all, 6 o'clock in the morning. No. And is that we too much credibility being able to understand or explain to ourselves. So, for one thing, human beings look like very numerous on the earth. You number like billion people. $6 is very, very, very. If there's 6 billion on the planet, they're very, very populated. Well, it would be interesting. Even are significantly less. I've come up with a tally of how many there are on planet Earth, and yet that number don't think that there are too many ants on it.
Hi there, it's LaVon. Hoping that our friend Joseph calls us back with a better connection. Unfortunately, I didn't hear a single thing that he said. So let's add him back to our group call here, and hopefully we can hear him. Are you there? I apologize. We didn't have the best connection. Can you hear me, Joseph?
I got to be connected. So I want to pick up that point because you may have to do this a couple times. The labor of ants on planet Earth is not a subject of travel most of the population of creatures on planet. I think you would also agree. You haven't heard anyone running around saying there's too many ants on Earth.
Right.
Okay, so if you follow me through with this logic, in the myriad of ways of distance, seems this to the environment. The Sari are as well of the environment. Effectively that would be pretty, pretty significant. Some could you like our jungle and all. What you'd if we're human beings, that very, very.
Is there any, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Joseph. Is there any way that you could, I know we're super far from each other, but is there any way that you can get to a higher point, like stand on a hill? We're having a really difficult time hearing your philosophy and following your logic.
Could try another advice and see if it has more power. It is a situation where I can't get through. I don't know. Don't listen for it because I'm here on a green island.
So. I understand. I'm kind of hearing you better now. I really appreciate your time. I want to make that clear. I know it's super early in the morning there. Are you able to hear me okay?
I can hear you absolutely perfectly for some reason.
I'm hearing like every third word from you. My My producer is saying if there's any way you could use a landline, but probably not.
There's no way I do a landline phone secondary.
I figured.
Okay. I don't know if it would be. I don't think there's any person downstairs to connect. This happens, which unfortunately is a computer
Right.
constantly trying.
I understand. I understand. But please try and continue. We're going to do our best to go on with the show. If I'm a little delayed in response, it's because I'm trying to catch up with what you've said. So please forgive me, but I want to pretty much give you the floor because you've got a lot to say. So please continue.
Okay, let me see if I can go down some type of thing. Of course, Skype. I mean, sometimes it's very, very good, the Skype connection.
Okay.
We'll just see what we can do. One second. I think I make better.
For a moment, it sounded someone was building a ship. No offense. It's just got to be our connection. You're worth the wait, not a problem.
To the university, it would be helpful. Okay.
I'm hearing you much better already.
Okay. So I'm closer to the end there. Let's see if it's here. You better help. Hello?
I'm here. Hello.
Can you hear me better now?
I can hear you much better. Thank you for your efforts, Joseph.
Okay. What I do is set the scenario to explain that the way we perceive the world is, first of all, a concern of imagination in many regards. It's also to say that certain people have inspirations to say the things they do,
Yes.
including myself. So one of the things that is important to understand the way we perceive the world is to perceive our cult of art. Of we just asked. So we have created our world of human beings a cult of anarchy. Hello, can you hear me?
Now I can.
Oh, okay, here. Is it better right here?
It is much better right there.
Okay, this is gonna be road then. So, is there any last explanation?
He's on an island, dear.
Here, I'm going to try another approach. I'm going to give you. Can you give me a phone number here, where someone can call, and what phone can call me? I'm going to go to Greece.
If you can hear me, Joseph, check your messages via Facebook and we can coordinate that way until we can figure out. I'm wondering if there's a way we could call you directly. I'm so sorry for this. I'm trying my best here. Awesome. Thank you. I'm going to tell my helper here. Thank you for being patient with us, everyone. Joseph travels the world sharing his message and his vision. And he's got a lot of important things to tell us in regards to health, wellness, and the future of humanity. No big joke. We're going to do our best here. Test, test. Can you hear me, Joseph?
Sorry.
I can hear you. I can actually hear you.
Okay, the country code is 4.
Okay, let me try and call you directly. If you can hear me, I'm going to call you from my personal number.
Yeah, I'm waiting for you, I think.
Okay, let's see how this goes. This might be the most expensive phone call I ever make. Let's do it. For the love of vegetables, everybody. I'm going to try and call Greece.
Did it go through?
Apparently I need a special calling card to call Greece. I didn't know about that. My tech is telling me that you just gotta find a stable spot, because the problem is the phone tower in which we're trying to reach you with. I'm so sorry for these delays. You can hear me clearly though?
I can hear you right now. This is an incredible Skype call. You're stuck.
Okay, so I'm hearing about every fourth word. So far, you're the clearest you've been. Should we give it a solid third round of an attempt?
Okay. So that means that you can call me call or from your end to me. This is can have this happen a lot of times because I'm so.
Yeah, this has never happened. I apologize. Not quite sure how we can fix it either. Let's see what I can do here. I'm going to try again to make a call to you and see what happens.
Okay, what? 0131.
Oh, it's okay. I got it in a message. You don't have to say it live. Let's see. I'm going to try my best here, though. Thank you.
too. I wanted to help you get this. Oh, excuse me. The country code is 30. Hello.
Hi there. I can hear you.
The country code is 30. Tell you about that. The gentleman knows the country code. That would help.
Okay. So I can hear you now, oddly. Okay, let me try again with that country code. All right. Sorry, I got my audience all excited for a show, and they're just listening to us try and talk. It's okay, all in due time. I'm confident in that. Let's see here. Let's see. Do you have a Skype that we can just connect directly to via Skype?
I do have Skype. Right.
I'm not sure if you called me. Okay, let's try this. Let's get creative here.
I'm on Skype right now on a call. See if you guys are better.
Okay.
Hang up. Waiting for your invitation.
All right. Thank you. Let's see. This is why I need an assistant. Yeah. Universe, send me an assistant. Come on, phone. Be my friend. Paste. I'm looking for you. If you can hear me, there you are. You're going to be my friend now. Let's be friends. I sent you a request. Because perhaps I can just add you via that, and we could have more success with our call. I'm most likely going to have to request more of your time so that we can, another day, so that we can get all of our wonderful points in that I know you have to say. Okay. Hi there. You're on with LaVon.
Yes, hello, LaVon. Do you have a better connection?
Oh my gosh! There you are! Yay! We did it! We're all technical and we're gardeners. We can save the world. Woo!
Okay, very good. So do we have a better connection? Can you hear me?
Most definitely.
Okay, well, this is absolutely perfect. So, excusing our own inability to correct this earlier.
It's okay.
True.
Thank you for your immense patience.
Perfect. Okay, so I have to recapitulate a few of the things that I was trying to introduce in a form of explaining why you're in particular situation that we are today in terms of thought.
Mm-hmm.
First thought is the world is overpopulated. The second is that we are responsible for saving the world. And then thirdly, trying to explain why there is a different scenario ahead for us, especially with regards to the future of humanity and feeding as the media likes to report an mm-hmm. ever-burgeoning population.
Right.
So to go back over this then is extremely important. Because many of the things that we perceive are secondhand. We perceive things secondhand, and often we perceive things that are secondhand that supposedly come to us from experts. Well, the cult of authority has influenced dramatically the way humans have thought for a very long time, but in the last 100 years, acceleration of the strength of the cult of authority has virtually dominated the world, because before did things in a certain manner of speaking, just because of tradition or just because of their intricate knowledge and relationship, same case with nature. Farmers grew things and farmers lived life, and they did not defer really to the cult of authority. That doesn't by any means disregard knowledge, because all of us would probably agree that knowledge is very important.
Mm-hmm. It's
a question of what is knowledge that is, and whether or not the so-called experts would concede, even they have what we call a skewed point of view, skewed for cultural reasons, skewed for professional reasons, skewed for personal reasons. So we all have skewed agendas. So the biggest thing that happens is that we are getting information and we're digesting that information, but maybe in the long run we would be more intelligent, carefully digest that information as it pertains to a bigger picture. So how do we write bigger pictures? So let me try to give a scenario that it's something about planet Earth. It's gigantic in one sense. We believe as a species that we are dominant. We see our effects all over the world, but maybe we see our effects more because we tune into what we do rather than what other creatures do. And my example often comes down to ants. Ants are very interesting because there's probably trillions of them on planet Earth.
Yes.
Yet in the media, you don't get much information about that there may be too many ants on the planet.
Right.
There's trillions of them. Now, they're much smaller than we are.
They're only second to bacteria, interestingly. Ants, only second to bacteria. There's so many. Go ahead.
So many ants. So we don't hear about ants being overpopulating Earth, but we hear about humans overpopulating Earth. And we like to concentrate on the fact how we're wiping out and how we're destroying things. But it's most likely that all of this pertains to our own ethnocentricities, our centricities as human beings, because we look at ourselves and we look at our relationship. And we're kind of feeling that we are controlling everything, which, in my estimation, after traveling all over the Earth, is not really true. We are causing visible symptoms of our existence, but we probably aren't controlling very much when it comes right down to it. So in one sense, we have a hyperinflated evaluation of our own importance, and we have a hyper-evaluated belief that we are going to somehow dominate this planet regardless. So those two little things. The cult of experts that would tell us that the world is overpopulated, and it would also tell us that we're in dire straits for the future of humanity because we don't have the opportunity to feed so many people. Mm-hmm. I mean, after all, 6 billion people on planet Earth right now. And the authorities would like us to understand that there are dire circumstances ahead of humanity, and the only way that we're going to save it as this goes is through creative technologies. We're going to come up with new and amazing technologies, and we're going to humanity. So that sounds palatable.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I can't a huge philosophical discourse in 1 hour, but it sounds palatable because we give credibility to experts. The thing is, experts, us, have trains of thought. Trains of thought are developed and accepted over long periods of time. People can cite religious beliefs. One group of people have one religious belief, another group of people has another religious belief, and if we were to pose the question which of them is correct, we're in a real mire because we can't really prove that any of them are correct, and we can't prove that any of them are false.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the same situation of these scientists saying the world is overpopulated, and the only way we're going to feed a hungry world is through technological innovation. Well, technological innovation in agriculture then allows me to introduce the major theme of what I hope to do today. And that is, we have a perspective on food that has resulted from a type of agriculture we have basically created in less than 100 years. Yes, agriculture has been going on for perhaps 8,000 years, for perhaps even 10,000 years, but the type of agriculture that we practice today, this agro-industrial agriculture, mm-hmm. is the result of the last 100 years. So that last 100 years of transformation of agriculture is then being used as the template for future, suggesting that what we have done in 100 years has to be modified even more to feed ever more people. And what necessarily results from that is that we have a very small selection of plants, because this is one of the results of intensified agro-industrial approach to agriculture. Number of plant species has been whittled down. Often in my talks all over the world, I cite that some 10 or 12 species of plants account for anywhere from 75, 85, 90% of the world's human carbohydrate needs. So all the humans in the world depend upon only 10 to 12 species of plants for the bulk of their calories in their diet. And it's not difficult to imagine this, because people in Asia eat rice. People in South America, in the Andes, eat potatoes. People in other parts of the temperate north eat wheat as the bulk of their caloric needs. Mm-hmm. And so we see that very few species are supporting humanity, which means, strangely enough, in this modern era where we have great interest in biodiversity, it's very strange that the number of crops that we eat is so insignificant. We should be eating many, 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 many more species of plants, and we incorporate those into our diet. So here, my case, and here is the point of what I'd like to share today. If we are talking about feeding an ever larger population, doesn't it seem rather strange that we would a few species of plants? And then comes to my next point, why are we so concerned with technological advancement and saying tinkering these 10 or 12 species rather than the world, as I do, for all the diverse plants that sustained humanity during the millennia down through the centuries, and start trying to grow those? So people would say, oh, all the good ones have already been found. I mean, after all, isn't it a logical result that if other plants were good, we would be using them for food? And Levon, this is the thing that is really amazing to me. It is true. It is not true that the best plants are being used. It's only true that certain plants are being used because they fell into a cultivation scheme early on that was replicated in almost a robotic fashion.
Yes.
So we did not go out and seek other plants.
You're talking about cash crops, and you're talking about capitalism, and you're talking about the depletion of our soil over time because of that, resulting in a weaker human because of that. And I agree, we've got to change our mode of thinking. We've got to be more objective, and we've got to think holistically. We've got to include all the organisms, all the species, because that's not only sustainable, but it's regenerative, which I think is very important. And I know you've got to touch on that.
Okay, so you're exactly right. And it is very, very useful to help steer me the direction that will better give this scenario to your listeners. So the point here then, as I recapitulate what I've done, they said, first of all, we have the expert's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And rather than saying that they are all wrong, I have tried to elicit in the viewers and the listeners questioning, well, where is their point of view coming from? Why do they have this point of view?
Mm-hmm.
And why should I maybe question their point of view? Because it doesn't necessarily prove to be true when examined from a microscopic, from a large world view.
Right.
My large world view doesn't see the world as being in danger of not being able to feed itself. In fact, now, a lot of people say experience is very important. Well, my experience is of a particularly strange sort, because I've now been to 109 countries, not just as a person and goes to an office and talks with experts. I fly into countries and I travel incessantly, sometimes for weeks at a time. I just spent 4 weeks traveling nonstop in India with the sole intent of examining the nature, of examining the environment, of examining how people interrelate their environment, and coming up in my mind scenarios that would then unfold for better use of their land mass. So this is the kind of thing that got over 105 countries now. The thing is, once you have that kind of perspective, the information, the data, the demographics that we are constantly fed start to be put into a different light. And that's why I question so much the position that first the world is overpopulated. And much of the world that I've been to, I've found myself that we need more humans to toil and kind of like giant earthworms to work the soil, to use it and to appreciate it in a way that is more loving than we're doing right now.
What a beautiful metaphor.
Yes.
I love that. I've never heard us compared to giant earthworms.
Well, and that's the way we really need to look at ourselves. And I think this is part of the amazing solution, is that soil is not appreciated for the magic that it is. And I tried to bring this forth in a way of a kind of an epiphany moment for people. It's not just a substance. It's just not a substrate. It's actually the point where community of ecosystems is most based. So the earth itself sprouts things up. Trees come out of the soil, but the soil itself is a living community. It's completely filled with organisms, be they microscopic, be they subterranean, terrestrial, whatever you want to talk about. The microbia, the bacteria, all of the grand symphony. And yet, we only look at soil as dirt, as some type of substrate. So once we can start imagining that as a community, it starts to take on a whole new relevance. And if we start living with that community, it replenishes us. And it can't make things too radical when you're talking to masses of people to try to tell them what the opportunities of the world are. So if we become more giant earthworms, the simple comparison, we start turning into a productive place, because we are tending to that community. And so as I've gone around the world, I see much land that is degraded. I see much land that is not used. I see marginal lands along streets and cities that is completely degraded. And the first point in my book is that you can start regenerating that and turning it into prosperous land communities, which then have a result for humanity of being productive in every sense of the word. So already, I'm saying we need more people to work rather than less. So that's in complete contradiction to what other people are saying.
Well, I love that you said that, because that fits right into my fantasy of having like as many children as possible and living on a giant farm. So yay. No, but in all seriousness, I agree with you. I think that the soil is so important. It's like the blood of our earth. And people forget that we don't live on the earth. We live in it. There's so many layers of atmosphere above us. And you're right. Like, our society and mostly the media has taught us otherwise. You know, we've become so detached. I like that you use that word often, because it's true. We are so detached. But how do people get reconnected? Like, what do you teach in your lectures worldwide?
Well, the first thing that inspires connection is to get connected in the first place. When I go around the world, I take out a slideshow.
Mm-hmm.
It's helpful in the audience when people start seeing diversity, because we're speaking in this case about food. When they start seeing the diversity of things that you can eat on the planet, they start saying to themselves, I never knew that any of this existed. So there's already this huge moment in which something dawns on somebody that they're missing out. So the mystery, the curiosity that we should have for nature has been all but, you know, extinguished, because we live modern life. We live life that are existing in nature but detached from nature. I mean, people drink milk. Milk comes from cows. Milk is a natural ingredient, but yet most in today's world don't even have an inkling of where milk comes from. Ugh. I mean, this is so bizarre. I mean, I cite this example. They gave a survey in the UK and in Australia and in the United States asking children where milk comes from, and a good percentage of them, maybe it's 30, 40%, thought it came from things like flour mixed with water. And I said, how can you fault them? Because, you know, kids go to the grocery store and they see soy milk, they see almond milk, they see cashew milk, they see coconut milk, they see flax milk. Well, if you've never seen a cow before and you're living in an apartment, playing on the video games all the time, how do you know what a cow is? I mean, that's kind of the distillation. So we are not connected with nature. We're not out farming. We're not out scavenging in the forest. So we don't exist anymore. And we rely upon a few people, so-called experts, in this discussion that I'm presenting today to tell us what things are for the future. So when somebody like Neil Fedorov, who was the science advisor for both countries of rice, Hillary Clinton gets up before a group of journalists, she's given pretty good credibility to say the only way we are going to feed a hungry world is through genetically modifying plants.
Oh, yeah. Don't you just love that? That's such a nice perspective. Let's break that shit down, though. Tell me why it's horrible.
Okay, well, first of all, let me try to say a couple things. As these people have tried to promote their propaganda, because it is propaganda, their message is that they want to advance biotechnology, and they claim that it's going to save them. Now, in that train of thought, we already are stuck in the last 100 years. The last 100 years of agriculture is what I call agro-industrial agriculture. Agriculture, which no longer looks at farming as a coexistence with nature, but look to dominate nature as if there is a war on nature. And how can I say this? Because we spray pesticides, the war on the insects, the war on various organisms that eat our crops. After all, we're creating giant smorgasbords for them of one species, trusting huge number of pests to a giant buffet. Also, we're applying herbicides. That's a war on plants. We are trying to kill the plants that we don't want growing. So we have another war. So we've kind of created this war with nature, which, as I contend, is a uphill battle because nature has been, in a sense, himself for millions and millions and millions of years, and nature always seems to win. So if we think we are going to win over nature, in the end, it will get us in some way, shape, or form, the result. So we have this agriculture, which is a war-based agriculture. We have this agriculture which is not considering the ecotopes of the environment, not considering the community of soil, as I mentioned, only considering soil as a substrate, because all we do is put plants in, and then we apply chemicals. We give it fertilizer. We give it trace minerals. We're treating it as a substrate rather than as a living community. Now, slowly but surely, even the scientists have to concede the soil treated only as a substrate seems to be giving us less and less in return for our agricultural involvement.
Mm-hmm.
You get plants that have less nutrition in them, as opposed to plants that may have more nutrition because of their coexistence with this symphony of life that lives in the soil. That's one part of it, but the other part of it is that this agricultural approach is very, very expensive, and it does not ever reach a balance with nature. Hence, it's always a state of war. But state of war is good economically, and it can be argued quite effectively that a state of war means that you have to continuously create input because you constantly are fighting for an output.
Mm-hmm.
And so it creates economy. But the question is it sustaining the economy or is it creating a devastating economy? I would claim that it creates a devastating economy.
For sure.
Because of all the things that I just said, applying huge quantities of pesticides, oils.
Have you ever thought about this? Just for a moment, entertain this idea. With homeostasis in your mind, what if we, because we're evolving too. Granted, we are depleting the soil, which is resulting in less nutritious food, which is resulting in less healthier individuals. And then over time, that it's already been 100 years. So we're three generations in deep of people not being nutritionally satisfied. Do you think that we're going to develop diseases and consequently become essentially like non-dependent on food? Like, bear with me here. Do you think that to counteract our damage, we will learn how to eat less but get more nutrition? Like, we have to evolve too. And haven't we already done that with our protein powders and our superfoods? Like, do you see us going in the future growing more nutritious things and eating less? Or do you...
You know, one of the things that Jared Diamond, who is very popular for his recent books in the last decade, like Guns, Germs, and Steel, Jared Diamond has been continuously discussing for over 30 years that agriculture, as we've created it over the last 8 or 9,000 years, has actually been something that's been rather devastating to humanity in these very terms, example, nutrition. And here's another thing to add into this. So diversity has not always been lacking in the human diet. It's a part of agriculture, the whittling down of the number of species that we use to eat that has resulted in us having serious deficiency in our diet. And part of that has to go from discussions. They go back to anthropologists. They go back to even studies of bones of ancient man, mm-hmm. to say that the forage-gathering peoples actually were larger and stronger and maybe more resilient than we are even today. And part of the reason that that could be substantiated is because they ate a very large, diverse diet.
Mm-hmm.
So the argument which Jared Diamond proposes is that as men and women settled and became agrarian, they were more likely to suffer famine, because if crops did not do well, they didn't know what to go eat in nature, so they would end up getting sick, they would end up dying because they were malnourished, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And he says that eventually, over time, reduction of the diversity of diet meant a much smaller intake of nutrients from all the previously diverse sources. I mean, imagine a forager, hunter, gathered to a forest and getting some of this and getting... picking this and picking that, and time we whittle down that nutritional bounty just to a few things like wheat, which could be a substantial part of many Northern European diets, mm-hmm. as the evolution of agriculture took place, meaning that there was a deficit of food, and especially the poor who were part of these earlier agrarian societies. Saying that part of the reason that the elite, the kings and queens and the rulers of past were so much more powerful, and were also more nourished.
Right.
They had a greater...
And they had suffered silver, pretty much. They,
exactly.
Yeah.
So then bringing that into the perspective today, that if agriculture then whittled down, conversely, because we think that, that would be the case, the amount of nutrients that humans were getting, and our agriculture is based on not only a smaller number of plants in our diet, but also a less nutritious, I believe, of plants in a diet, it would seem that we are suffering from nutritional deficiencies. So I've often asked if there's some benefit of constant traveling, and one of the things that I've come to conclude is that I change habits. I change eating habits so frequently that I don't ever fall into doldrum of eating the same thing over and over again.
Lots
and hence, in a certain way, constantly adding to my diet.
You must be very healthy. Because our immune systems are responsive. And I think that's part of, like, to agree with what you're saying, why people aren't well, is they're eating so few things that their body has become, it's kind of like, what's the word?
Deprived.
Not only deprived, it's lazy. It's not challenged. Your immune system doesn't have to work or change. It's neutral. It's very neutral. And we're not designed for that.
But these are all, you know, great possibilities. I mean, when we start talking about this again, we have a cult of personalities and a cult of authorities as what we should be thinking about food. But if
right.
you look at a number of cult of authorities, you're going to find that there are about as many different perspectives about a healthy diet as there is so-called authority. So you end up, you know, being as confused as that. It's the best thing that I've been able to distill out of this. And I think about all the superfoods, because actually I talk a lot about superfoods,
mm-hmm.
is that a diverse diet is the biggest benefit that you can possibly have to having a maximum range of nutrition. So just eat all kinds of things.
Seasonally.
And, you know,
right? Yeah. Would you, seasonally, that's the best way to get diversity, is to eat with a season?
Well, that's absolutely utopic, but I mean, seasonality doesn't really occur for the 99.99% of people.
But I wish it did. But if it did, I think it would all be well. That's my little dream there. But tell me about your solution. We've been talking about we've talked about the past, we've talked about your travels, and we've talked about the deprivation of nutrition that is pretty evident in most of the people, especially in America. But what's your solution? Can we talk about Gardens Across America? Are you talking about that yet? Because I think
I would love to speak about Gardens Across America. Give me a time scenario. Where are we at?
We've got about 7 more minutes. But if you want to close out the show talking about that, as a segue into me catching up with you, hopefully soon, and speaking on it for a lot longer, that would be lovely.
Well, we've really rested on today. I know that we were really choppy and bumpy. So if your listeners stay true, I hope it then makes sense. So here's your explanation for a solution.
Okay.
The idea that there is this magnificent planet with some 200, 300, 400, 500,000 species of plants on it. Again, experts are not in complete agreement as to what those number of species are. It turns out that if we say, 10% of the planet Earth are useful for food production, it gives us anywhere from 30,000 to 50,000 species of edible plants. And that's very conservative because I've been studying them for a very long time, and I'm fascinated how many plants produce food for human beings. So if we are using, as I said earlier, only 10 or 12 species for the bulk of humanity's carbohydrate needs, it makes sense that we should be examining for the future all the plants that human beings use all over the planet down through the millennia to sustain themselves. Think of the hunter-foragers who were in the Kalahari Desert. Think of the hunter-forager-gatherers who were in the mountains, the Rocky Mountains. All over the world, human beings were gathering plants. Why are these plants not being used? It's not because they're not useful for food. It isn't because they don't have potential to produce food, even in agrarian systems. It's because they left behind in the race forward, if that's what we should call it, as human beings were picking and choosing the crops they would grow and the ones that they would adapt, left behind. So people say to me, okay, you're talking about wild plants, you're talking about the great wilderness. How are we going to tame some of these plants, and how are we going to grow them, and how are we going to eat them? So the experts in many scenarios with me, how-to question of domestication, because that's what they're really talking about. Well, the first thing is, we don't necessarily have to domesticate a plant in order to grow it.
Okay.
Best experts on this are the people who are in California who are growing ornamental plants. There's a great diversity of ornamental plants that feed. They're actually wild plants. Just because somebody puts it into a pot, gravel in it, doesn't turn into a domesticated plant. They're actually growing wild plants, and guess what? They're doing a very good job of doing so.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense of cultivation, it's not outside the realm of possibility to imagine that we can take a wild food species and plant it, produce a plant which its attributes, in this case food, that we can then take out. So we don't have to domesticate everything to grow it. In fact, we don't have any example that tells us to the contrary. So then the next question is, you have this interesting plant in nature. It produces a tuber, but the tuber is not very big. Well, it looks like a long, long road to domesticate it so we can get bigger tubers. Well, yes, but get some examples from modern practical world. The Dutch, I just spoke at Green Tech. Green Tech is a conference exposition in Holland, which is now attracting the top horticultural and agricultural innovators in the world. I was a keynote speaker there, and the subject which I presented is exactly what I'm sharing with you. The domestication of wild species is not without precedent. In fact, the Dutch have been doing it now for several decades for the floriculture and horticulture industry. mean by this? We take a beautiful plant that some plant explorer may have found in the jungle of Brazil, or may have found in the jungles of Peru, or may have found in tropical Asia, and they bring them to greenhouses in Holland. They have a fleck of pink. They have a fleck of yellow. It maybe has a stripe. And over time, through just simple, old-fashioned horticulture, they breed and they select, and before long they have these glorious plants which they can then sell in the Dutch flower market. So the point is, they have taken a wild plant, they have studied its genetics, and then improved it in a fashion that makes it more pretty, and they sell it to people. That's a fast track to domestication. If we took those thousands and thousands of species mm-hmm. that are out there that have potential, and instead of finding ourselves with these obscure biotechnologies which are questionable value in nature to us, they have questionable value in nature to us because, first of all, they aren't truly magnificent incarnations of nature. They're muddlings and playing around by human beings. Now, I'm not excluding value of understanding and creating biotechnology. I'm not excluding that. But I'm saying, why don't you sit there and work on 10 or 12 things when you have thousands? Well, the simple reason is you're not curious anymore. You're not inspired. Only a machine. And I'm then now saying, and you're hearing me proclaim this, that these people who are in this mindset are what were technological tinkers who don't have a greater inspiration. They don't share the mystery of nature because they're not curious enough to know the mystery of nature. Wherever I go, and I sit in these conferences all the time, I'm amazed.
I'ma let them know, no, through the stereo. Yo, here we go, go through the stereo, stereo. Truth on the Tracks, you can catch every Monday night and Friday night at 9 p.m.